Body of the House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. Excuse us being just a little bit late. We had some business we had to take care of. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Millet. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Here.
Representative Gaddis.
Here.
Representative Hughes.
Here.
Representative Isaacson.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Chair Lynn.
Here. Thank you and good morning, everybody. Today, on our agenda, just one bill on the agenda. That's House Bill number 127. And I would invite who's representing the Ombudsman this morning? Good morning. Would you please introduce yourself and just give a very minuscule review of where we are on this? As I recall, we walked through the sectional on this thing, spent a lot of time on the portion involving the Bar Association. We didn't talk about 12 and 13. So we did make any opening comments you'd like to make, then we'll have some discussion around the table what I think we're going to do with this.
To the chair, thank you. I'm Beth Leibowitz. I'm an assistant ombudsman. Ombudsman Linda Lord Jenkins is also available on the phone from Anchorage.
Good.
And if you'd like, I'll talk about section 12 a little bit.
Okay.
Unless you would like me to recap the other sections.
Well, just in not more than 3 minutes.
Understood. Thank you. We're asking for several housekeeping provisions. Aside from the section on the Bar Association that has received a lot of attention, we're asking for three sections that deal with confidentiality, to have our testimonial privilege modernized, to remove some of our communications with executive branch agencies from the public records over there in the executive branch offices, so that when we issue them a confidential investigative report, the whole trail of correspondence leading up to that report is not hanging out there available as a public record. And we are asking for an anti-waiver provision to protect agencies that want to share attorney-client privileged material with us so that it does not cause them undue harm by accidentally waiving their privilege as to everyone else when they provide us with information. We cannot compel that information, but we do have executive branch agencies that would like to be able to explain why they're doing what they're doing. And we're asking for a change to our procurement statute to bring it into accord with the Legislative Council procurement policies. And we're asking for a mechanism to provide an informal investigative report so that we can have a clear statutory process that to deal with things that do not require a full 20 or 50-page investigative report but do require some level of investigative attention. We're also asking to have the ombudsman's salary unfrozen from Step A, Range 26. And in the realm of jurisdictional questions, we're asking for jurisdiction over certain types of private contractors, and we propose to extend that to certain types of grantees because it's clear that saying contractors and ignoring grantees will not actually accomplish the goals very effectively. I believe you may have some alternate language to that effect.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions at this point? Okay. The 12, we did not cover 12 and 13. Would you just briefly address, I think it was 12 and 13, was it not? There's some question on that?
Yes, to the chair, that is correct.
Yeah. Would you cover those sections, please?
To the chair, section 12 basically it amends our definition of agency to include some entities that are not state government agencies but are acting on behalf of state agencies. The first and foremost of these are contractors for the Department of Corrections, for a contractor that's providing custodial services. And currently that would be Hudson Correctional Center in Colorado, which is being phased out, but we still have apparently almost 800 inmates there as of last week. So they're not done yet. And we have quite a few halfway houses across the state that are run by either for-profit or non-profit private entities. And again, that's under contract with Department of Corrections. The people in the halfway houses are inmates. The Department of Corrections still has custody and power over them, but they're being housed and basically off campus. And that's fine, but we would like to have jurisdiction over those facilities.
I love the word campus.
Well, nice way of putting it.
Yes, it is. So basically now, if you get a complaint from an inmate, a prisoner someplace, you must do your investigation through the Department of Corrections rather than going directly to the campus outside the state or somebody. Is that correct?
To the chair, that is correct. And what that means is that we can refer a complainant to the Department of Corrections to say, well, you need to address that issue with Department of Corrections, and then we can inquire of Department of Corrections what they did with that issue, but we can't get directly to the problem.
Would you intend to notify the Department of Corrections before you go to the off-site campus?
Not necessarily, and that in large part that is because we expect that quite a few of these will not be complaints of great note. If it's something that can be resolved with a, you know, three-minute phone call, then carefully doing a notification to Department of Corrections every time we do that doesn't seem to make sense. What we do intend to do is, one, do regulations, because if we get jurisdiction over contractors, that's going to require some slightly different procedures than simply dealing with regular state agencies. And two, what I expect will happen is that we'll be providing Department of Corrections with an update, you know, either every couple of months or at least every year, basically saying, hey, here's the type of complaints we got, here's how many we got, here's the contractors that we dealt with, and that if we have anything that's more serious that requires investigative summary or report, that Department of Corrections will be getting a confidential copy of that before we publish anything.
Doesn't that kind of take the Department of Corrections out of the loop? They find about it, you know, after the fact. I'm trying to think, if I were in charge of corrections and somebody did that to me, I'd be a little irritated.
Well, I'll have to let Department of Corrections answer that to some extent. But I will say that our primary mechanism for dealing with complaints with the Department of Corrections is to refer inmates into Department of Corrections grievance process. And we don't expect that to be terribly different for people in halfway houses. We do. If we have something that looks like it could be resolved with a quick inquiry, we would like to be able to make that inquiry. But we expect the vast majority of these complaints to be what we would call premature, which is they haven't tried to work it out within the system yet. And we expect to still be referring them to that system.
Right. Thank you. Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason you're asking the question, it begs the question that you probably have had some experience with investigations going a lot slower or maybe with incomplete information because you have not had access. How often, in the Department of Corrections, for example, and Health and Social Services, has that happened to you that I want a general response. I know you don't have specifics, but this is because you have encountered problems, right?
To the chair and to Representative Keller, we have encountered some problems, and there are cases that we probably didn't run smack into the problem because we declined the issue as non-jurisdictional at the time. But we do have a handful of cases out of Hudson which involved medical complaints, basically lack of appropriate medical care in each of the allegations. These allegations proved to be ultimately unsupported, but it took us a very long time to find that out, because rather than going directly to Hudson and asking them to offer up their comments and their medical records so that we could see what was going on, we were going through Department of Corrections, and then they were going to Hudson. And by the time we went through that shuffle, it took a lot longer than it probably should have.
Reverend Christ Tompkins.
What is the scale of complaints, both residential treatment programs within the Department of Health and Social Services, as well as halfway houses, residential services, and prisons under contract with the Department of Corrections, in terms of total number of complaints that you've had to decline because you don't have jurisdiction?
Okay. To the chair and to Representative Christ Tompkins, If you'll give me a minute, I'm going to flip open to my outline of how many we've had, so. All right, this is going over the last roughly decade, and in that we've had about 88 complaints involving either Arizona Red Rock or Hudson Correctional Center, basically the out-of-state prison facilities. And then we've had 147 complaints involving halfway houses. And this is a small percentage of relative to the total number of complaints we get from Department of Corrections. But we do get these. They're coming in. We expect they'll continue to come in. Some of these were opened and actually investigated to the best of our ability within the constraints that we currently have. Many of them were declined as non-jurisdictional, especially the halfway house complaints. I don't have a breakdown to tell you exactly how many were at each, but most of these would have been declined with a referral to basically contact the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Reverend Gannis.
Well, I'm just curious, what kind of complaints do you typically get that you have to turn away? I mean, I heard that you talked about the medical complaints.
To the chair and to Representative Gaddis, is the medical complaints we actually did not turn away in that they sounded urgent, and we did our best to find out what was going on rather than simply declining them. The complaints that we get, for instance, from Hudson are pretty much the same as the types of complaints that we get from inmates at the state facilities, which range from they're not answering my cop-outs or my grievances, or I'm afraid some of them amount to this is not a nice place to be. And I'm, you know, that we can't really fix that part, you know, and we probably shouldn't. But we do get, basically the complaints are similar to the state institution complaints. The halfway house complaints, again, tend to be similar, but I have a couple of examples here.
If I might.
Yes, please continue.
I have to admit, I'm not sure what the, you said that they're similar to the Department of Correct or the state. I'm not familiar with those ones either. So the complaints are just that my grievances aren't being dealt with, and certainly that's not a nice place. Is that what the kind of complaints that you deal with?
Those, to the chair and to Representative Gaddis, those are a lot of them. We also get complaints about medical care. Occasionally we get complaints about food or about the lack of a diet appropriate to a medical condition. And we get complaints about disciplinary and classification. Those tend to have a pretty clear-cut appeal process, so we're often not very involved with those because the inmates are expected to follow a pretty set appeal route. And if they haven't done that, we're not too inclined to be a substitute for that option. And I'd like to, if Linda Lord Jenkins is on the line, perhaps she could speak a little bit to it since she's been with the office longer than I have.
Mr. Chairman, this is Linda Lord Jenkins, State Ombudsman. In response to Representative Gaddis's question through the chair, Beth has summed up a lot of the complaints. Other complaints involve the DOC's ban on certain visitation. Sometimes relatives are not allowed to visit inmates for reasons such as the relatives are also on probation for a felony conviction, that sort of thing. I did actually include a list of the sorts of complaints in the annual report that we distributed. It is disciplinary. People think they're being treated very unfairly in disciplinary actions. Classification, which would mean that they're held at a different custody status. If they've not been good in prison and they have a serious violent crime, they might be held at a higher security status than someone who's in prison for a DUI, that sort of thing. Any number of things I understand that you're new to this particular agency, so any number of things that inmates want to complain about, they complain about. And as Ms. Leibowitz said, we generally, if they have not gone through an available administrative process, we route them into the grievance or appeal process, grievance for just an unusual complaint appeal process if the classification, if they're not happy with the, satisfied with the classification and believe there's something flawed in the decision. We do tend to get more involved, in the, in regular DOC agencies and in the contract prisons, if there is a serious medical issue that, referring folks to a grievance or an appeal, process would be, would not be appropriate, if you've got, say, somebody who's been having really serious problems with not getting their insulin for diabetes situations. Let's say we had a complaint about somebody who said that he was told by his physician that he had a blocked carotid artery and he should have surgery, and the private prison did not provide that surgery for him. Those sort of things we take more serious, and we'll push the envelope a little bit for a couple of reasons. One, it's a life, and they were not sentenced to prison to be a death sentence. And there is an awful lot of liability for the state if they're not treated properly by the contract facility. Does that answer your question, ma'am?
Yes, and I'll look at the review. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah. Hello, Linda. Good to have you here. Back. The when these kind of investigations come up, I know it's awfully difficult to work backwards from a complaint to the to potential violations, you know, but would you make a general back up a little bit? When we're talking a contractor or a privatized group, we're talking situations where they act on behalf of the state of Alaska. They're acting with dollars that we authorize in the legislature. So the standards, you know, that are followed are, of course, we have a level of responsibility there. And what I would like is, if you don't mind, have you found the that the agencies of the state of Alaska have been clear and adequate in their standards, in their grant administration standards, for example, or the contracts that they have? Are they clear? The regs, you know, that this is based on. Have you found a clear link? I mean, I'm sure that's part of your investigative process to try to identify what's being violated. Have you found the agencies to have a clear description of those things?
Representative Keller, through the chair, again, because we really have not been able to investigate these private contractors, we have not made an analysis of what DOC has been, DOC, for example, what they have included in their contract. We have reviewed the contract facility's contracts, but the question is not what's in the document. The question is how the document is implemented. And so if we were to rely solely on the allegations made by inmates at Hudson or at Red Rock, you come to one conclusion, but since we can't really look at those allegations because we have no statutory jurisdiction, we really have no way of knowing how a lot of these contracts are being implemented. We've seen a couple instances, certainly in the medical complaints, where we have had concern, and we certainly think that DOC should have concern, and we've brought it to their attention, but we haven't done a contract audit in those instances. Does that answer your question?
Right.
Yeah, a follow-up on that. Yes and no. Take the insulin example, insulin administration example. An inmate says, I'm not getting my insulin, therefore, my rights are being stepped on here. And it just seems to me like that the department would have very strict guidelines on administration of drugs and prescriptions. You know, it'd be very, very high standard there. I'm pretty confident. And so what you're saying is you want to have the authority to go in and look at Hudson and Red Rock to see exactly what's happening so you can evaluate whether or not the Department of Corrections standards are being fulfilled. Is that the picture?
Representative Keller, through the chair, yes.
Thank you.
And would that be Would the Department of Corrections know about this before you went in?
Mr. Chairman,
I'm here.
Traditionally, when we make contact with an agency based on a complaint, and this is any agency, it's part of our investigative methodology to go to the person, the agency employee, who is closest to the subject of the complaint and work, take it up the line from there. Because the person who, say, the caseworker who made a decision in a complaint about eligibility determinations, has the personal knowledge that about an individual complaint. If we think then, and when we talk to them, we ask them about their understanding of policies and procedures, et cetera. And if we think that there's something lacking with that particular caseworker's actions, we would then go to the supervisor and up the line, because we want to know precisely what happened. We have found, and it's my strong belief based on my experience, that if you go to central office right away, what you often get is a sanitized version of what should happen, but not always what did happen. And so that's why we go to the individual employees involved first. And often it's a mistaken understanding of policy. It might be a communications breakdown between the citizen and the employee. Citizens might not have been reading the material that the agency has given them closely. Any number of things. But as Ms. Leibowitz said, a lot of these complaints don't really merit the level of disturbing the commissioner or the director about it, certainly until we find that there's a problem, and then we would bring it to their attention.
Could I have one more follow-up?
Go ahead, Reverend Keller.
Just a real quick follow-up on that, Linda. I'm sitting here thinking if I was a private contractor, you know, for the state, for the corrections or whatever, how I would feel about somebody coming in and investigating, and my guess is it would be a pretty defensive, negative response by some of the contractors, and that's why this is a tough issue. It's more a statement, but do you anticipate resistance from contractors out there on this issue? And also, if you would add to that, how these you feel, because there's another element to this too. If I was a contractor and I began to see what was going on, I might really, really welcome this, because it's somebody else looking at my relationship with the, you know, on the contract, contractual agreement with the state, and to have a third party looking at it, a fair one, might be a real asset. So that's. I'm not prejudicing the question. I want to know what you think will be the reaction.
Representative Keller, through the chair, yes, we, in my years experience dealing with agency responses to our contact, you do get agencies and employees who are very defensive or wary about the contact. But frankly, that comes with the territory. If you're going to be working on in state government, part of that work may entail having an ombudsman contact you. Ombudsman staff are trained to be very professional, and they are very professional, and our goal is not to put heads on our wall. Our goal is to make sure that government and its employees are acting the way that they should be acting. I guess my response to contractors who had concerns about the ombudsman making contact about individual complaints would be that we are impartial. We are not advocates for either a complainant or the contractor or the state agency. We are there as impartial neutrals to find out just what happened. And we often find that when we have complaints, and if we into those complaints and we come up with an answer on the complaints, whether it be that the agency did something that they shouldn't have, or they didn't implement a policy as it should have been implemented, or if the agency did everything right, that often the complainant takes our word, our judgment in that matter, and because we are impartial, they seem to put a lot more faith in it. I would also say to the contractor, like I would say to state employees, it comes with the territory. Your housing, in the instance of DOC, you are acting as a surrogate for the state of Alaska, and you are housing Alaska prisoners. You have contractual obligations that you have to act as a state employee would act, and the ombudsman is part of that process. So it comes with the territory. We don't make more money when we find that the agency has done something wrong. We don't make less money when we find that the agency has done something right. We are there to make sure the agency or a contractor would be doing what they're supposed to do.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I have an order. Representative Millett is excused. She's participating in a different committee. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Beth and Linda. I have two questions. The second one is going to be follow-up to Representative West and the Chair, but I'm going to ask the first one quickly because the other one might involve more conversation, and that is considering all the current contracts that are underway through the Department of Health and Social Services and DOC, contracts and grants, we'll add, would this be retroactive to any existing and would language need to be added to contracts so that the facilities would realize that the ombudsman would have jurisdiction over them? So just wondering if current contracts, if we were to pass this with as is, if they could then go into the facility, that you'd have jurisdiction over the current ones.
To the Chair and Representative Hughes, the answer to that is no. We've set this to basically the language that we have proposed would have this effect, contracts and grants that come into existence after January 1st, 2015. We set this well ahead, not retroactive, but very prospective, because we expect this to come in gradually and not be a surprise to anyone when it comes in.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Follow-up?
And that was my answer. I just wanted to clarify that was my understanding. So the second question is follow-up to the earlier discussion, just so we better understand. We have contract facilities. Let's talk about Department of Corrections first. We have contract facilities for adults and juveniles in-state and out of state. They have internal grievance processes. Does the Department of Corrections in this instance have access to these grievances that are filed at these contract facilities during the process, so and aware of them, and are they following, for instance, down in Hudson, I'm assuming they're using an internal grievance process that is set up for their facility and doesn't reflect anything in the state of Alaska's process. Is that correct? I'm just wondering how much the Department of Corrections is aware and monitoring, and how much it is in alignment with what we have here, and whether we know that they're being well served. We know what the process is here. Just wondering, with the contract facilities, how much knowledge, and whether you can answer that. That might be Department of Corrections, but can you respond to that?
Go ahead.
To the Chair and Representative Hughes, first part of that is that for juveniles, we'll need to talk about health and social services, since Department of Corrections does not handle those. For my understanding, and Department of Corrections may need to speak more to this, my understanding is that for Hudson, the grievance processes are supposed to be parallel and more or less the same as they are for Alaska institutions, for the people held under contract. What I cannot answer for you is how closely DOC is monitoring that. I think there is some degree of monitoring, both for Hudson and for the halfway houses. How active that is one of the questions that we don't have enough data to answer at this point.
Okay, and follow-up. And so for the juvenile with DHSS, would it be the same then?
To the Chair and Representative Hughes, that we've received, admittedly, far fewer complaints involving the juvenile facilities, and I think that is probably because they do have a more active monitoring, since juveniles usually are going back in for court hearings periodically throughout the time that they are in the facility. And because those facilities are more, the residential facilities are more therapeutic, I think they are more tightly regulated. So we have less information indicating problems there. They do have to have grievance setups, and Division of Behavioral Health could probably speak to the type of grievance policies and procedures that they expect the juvenile residential facilities to have in place.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up, please.
And as you work with even outside this area in any of the agencies, are you ever concerned that the internal grievance process itself, the process is inadequate, and do you ever advise so the internal process can be improved so that maybe things don't end up in your lap?
To the chair and representative Hughes, that is one of the primary functions of the Ombudsman's Office. We cannot handle every complaint about every agency by a long shot. So one of our functions is to encourage agencies to have complaint resolution systems that function efficiently, impartially enough to take care of real problems and to basically resolve these things. So basically looking to see if the grievance mechanisms are working is one of the main things that we do. We refer people to grievance processes. If we keep getting people bouncing back to us because the process is not responsive, then we become increasingly concerned, and that's more likely to lead to a large systemic investigation.
Okay, thank you. That's good. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I stated before, I see great value in the Office of the Ombudsman. Over the years, I've seen how it's been very practicable. I was concerned in the discussion between the Ombudsman and Representative Keller on the idea of contractors, or I suppose anyone in the system, reacting negatively to queries from the Ombudsman's Office. And I'm wondering about the impact of retaliatory behavior. Especially we were talking in this section, Section 12, about possible contractors out of state and so forth, and the old adage, out of sight, out of mind. Could you talk to us about whether or not there is retaliatory behavior, what can you do to intervene, how do you follow up in that circumstance, how do you communicate that to the department, et cetera?
I'd like to hand that one to the Ombudsman and her greater experience in this area.
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, we...
Identify yourself, please.
I'm sorry. This is Linda Lur Jenkins, the Ombudsman, State of Alaska Ombudsman. On occasion, we have had allegations from complainants that they are being retaliated against. On occasion, we've had complainants express concern that they might be retaliated against. Certainly DOC knows that it's not acceptable. And we, in my experience since working in the office since 1989, I can't think of very many cases where we have had that, any indication that that has happened. Our process, normally when we communicate our findings to agencies, is to advise them that complainants, witnesses, anyone assisting the Ombudsman in an investigation is protected under the whistleblower statute, and that citizens have the absolute right to complain about their government. And we usually have a lot of buy-in with that. My intent would be if this legislation were to pass and we were to gain jurisdiction over the contract facilities and nonprofits dealing with eligibility determinations, would be that we would prepare material and do on-site training for the contractors so that they understood the role of the Ombudsman, the history of the Ombudsman, and how the Ombudsman works with agencies or contract facilities.
Thank you.
Reverend Isaacson?
No, that's good. I appreciate the answer.
Any other questions for Reverend Hughes?
When you mentioned contract nonprofits, it made me, I recall the fact that I've heard that we have more nonprofits per capita than any other state. So it got me to thinking how, and I know you wouldn't, they're not all involved in this way as far as contracts and grants, but it would really increase the number of cases, I imagine, that you might be covering, because I'm thinking the Department of Health and Social Services and Department of Corrections, what are the total number of these facilities that you would now be covering, and how would that impact your workload? Because right now you can't move forward on these cases. So
to the chair and Representative Hughes, that's what the number of nonprofits and the number of grants that the state provides to do various services is the reason why the language in Section 12 has been written and actually proposed to be rewritten. So because we are trying to get a very narrow slice of things that we think are particularly important, because we're aware that we're probably not in a position to go and pick up all of that area. That's a very large scope, and that would require quite a few more staff than we have at present. As to more immediately in answer to your question, there are 8 halfway houses, 1 the contract prison, and I believe there's somewhere between a dozen and 2 dozen juvenile residential facilities in this category. Some of those are multiple facilities held by one nonprofit who will have various levels of custody or have a boys' facility and then a girls' one. So there's basically, I'd say, roughly a dozen nonprofits that are providing the type of juvenile residential treatment that we're looking at, and then about 8 or so halfway houses. In the category of eligibility determinations, we're not sure how many we'll pick up, but we are trying to tailor that very narrowly to reach only those nonprofits that are actually making a threshold determination of yes or no, you get to enter this program, rather than every type of nonprofit social service.
Reverend Hughes.
Can you explain to us, for those that are determining the eligibility, this is eligibility for what? And can you give us an example of a nonprofit agency that would fall under that category?
To the chair and Representative Hughes, an example would be, right now, the language that we are proposing refers to any state program or benefit. So, and one example is actually the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's low-income weatherization program, which is been a pretty successful state program. But one thing that they do is that the administration of the program, including determining whether someone is within the income threat, is under the income maximum, and that would qualify for the program, is done by regional grantees. In other words, there's someone at a grantee organization who is looking at the application and saying, yes, you qualify to come into this program, or no, you do not qualify.
President Hughes?
Would it also include all those that determine whether someone is eligible for any sort of public assistance or Medicaid? It seems like that might be quite a few entities.
To the chair and Representative Hughes, it looked like it might be quite a few. Upon meeting with the director of the Division of Public Assistance, it appears that division, at least, has retained quite a bit of control over the actual determination of who will qualify to enter our program. They have a lot of grantees performing a lot of services, but they've held the reins more tightly than I might have expected. They do have at least one program, child care. Program office does grants, again, to regional grantees who administer the program, and if you are trying to get child care assistance, then you go to the grantee rather than to the Division of Public Assistance. And that's one where the grantee actually is, again, looking at the application and saying, oh, do you qualify or do you not qualify? For areas such as temporary assistance, the main cash assistance program, there's a lot of grantees working in that area. But my understanding is that the Division of Public Assistance has retained the yes or no, you get to have assistance or not determination in-house.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? If not, I'd like to thank you very much for information brought before this this committee. You know, a lot of this reminds me. Most people know I'm a retired Air Force, and at one time I served on the Air Force Inspector General team, actually in procurement, and we handled much of the same type of thing ombudsmen's do. You know, we'd get a complaint from somebody, and we go out and investigate the complaint, and we filled some of that function. So it kind of brings me back home again. It was a good, worthwhile job. And this whole ombudsman program is just extremely important in all of its different aspects. And it seems to me that there's more to consider, more than meets the eye, not only in this bill that's before us today, but also in the entire ombudsman program, because it's so very important to the states and the various agencies involved in how we conduct business in this great state of Alaska. So, in addition to things we've already discussed today, there are tremendous issues of balance of power between the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. This is a big subject, and I think it's too important to rush it through without a very thorough examination of what we're talking about here, more than we can handle probably in a regular committee session. So with that in mind, I'm going to ask for a subcommittee, going to form a subcommittee of this committee, and I would invite Vice Chair Keller to head that subcommittee, and I invite Reverend Gaddis and Reverend Christ Tompkins to be part of that subcommittee to meet and go into this whole thing, not just the bill, but the entire ombudsman's program, and report back to us with recommendations and policies, you know, et cetera. And I would state that other members of the committee, of course, typically in a subcommittee, are invited to participate to whatever degree they would like to anticipate. And I can see the chair of the subcommittee may want to call on some members of the ombudsman's office and others to help them in their deliberation, and I ask them to report back to our full committee with a report of what they looked at and some of the policy recommendations and why. With that, I'd like to Vice Chair Keller.
I welcome the responsibility and the trust that you put in the subcommittee to work on this, and I take it seriously, and I think it's very significant. I think that this is a core identity issue for the legislature. I really am grateful that the bill has come forward. It's an opportunity for us, and I thank the ombudsman for doing it. It gives us a chance for a bit of introspection, and it gives us a chance to ensure at some level that the policies that we make, the allocations that we make, are actually accomplishing what we envision. And also, like the chair has said, it's also important to ensure that we're doing the right thing is in the balance of power between the legislative and the other branches in the state of Alaska. I welcome the opportunity to review the entire statute and the bill, and to make at some future point the subcommittee bring back policy options for this committee. And I would say right up front, I invite anybody on the committee to join us in this effort. So thank you.
Any comments from the committee? Again, I'd like to thank the ombudsman for bringing the bill forward, and you've had some great testimony. Our next meeting is Thursday, and we're going to be hearing HCR 3, Joint Committee on Federal Overreach, SCR 10, Arctic Policy, United Coast Guard and Arctic Council, and HB 59, Missing Vulnerable Adult Response Plan. If there's no other business come before the committee, thank you, everybody. We are adjourned.